You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriting. My name is Mark Lintzenmeyer. My guest for episode 59 is Annie Haslam, and you just heard her beautiful voice on the introduction to her 1977 album Annie in Wonderland, and right now you're hearing the biggest single she's been associated with, Northern Lights, from the 1978 album A Song for All Seasons by her band Renaissance. Now, Renaissance has an interesting history. It was started in 1969 by ex-members of the Yardbirds, a band name associated with Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, and Jimmy Page. Also, Keith Ralph and Jim McCarty from that band started Renaissance, switching from the Yardbirds blues style to create a folky symphonic unit featuring a prominent female singer. Now, after two albums, all the people in that original band were gone, except for the non-band member lyricist Betty Thatcher, who, along with new guitarist Michael Dunford, wrote the song you are listening to right now. So Annie was the singer, the front woman, though not the writer, for this brand new band from 1972 through the mid-80s, over 9 studio albums, and it's only after that point, when she started doing more solo albums, that she started writing her own lyrics, starting with her 1989 self-titled album. We're going to start off our discussion with Blessing in Disguise, the title song from her 1994 album, written with Tony Visconti, best known as the producer of many of David Bowie's best-loved albums. We'll then turn to the new iteration of Renaissance, Annie reformed with Michael Dunford, to record an album called Grandine il Vento from 2012 to 2013. Now, Michael passed away soon after that, but this still is very much a functioning live band touring right now. For our second song, we're going to be talking about the title track of that album, although subsequently the album was re-released in 2014 with the name Symphony of Light, which is the name of the final track on the album, and you're going to hear it at the very end of this episode. But before that, we're going to turn to another co-write with Michael Dunford, a song called Precious One from Annie's solo album, 2000's The Dawn of Ananda. You can learn more about Annie at anniehaslam.com and also at renaissancetouring.com. To learn more about this podcast, check out nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. If you enjoy what we're doing here, please consider making a donation at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. So I will have played during my introductory speaking the intro lees from Annie in Wonderland, and then I thought I'd jump to a bit of Northern Lights, since a lot of people will know you from that.
Right.
So it's kind of a long trip, of course, chronologically, and in terms of the growth of your songwriting to get to the current work here, because I noticed, you know, this is a songwriting podcast, and that was not your initial...
No, it wasn't.
Pull to the industry, pull to being in the band. So when it seemed like it was a pretty gradual thing in the late 80s that you actually started writing your own lyrics?
Yeah, it was. I think I had a go towards the end of Renaissance when it was just Michael Dunford, myself and John. And I had a go at writing some things, but I wasn't totally into it. I look at it completely different now. I look at it like my painting, and I just seem to kind of channel the words rather than struggle to make them up. Do you know what I mean? I did write One Love and Celestine from my Epic album. That was 1989. Celestine and She's the Light was with Larry Fast. You probably know Larry Fast from Synergy and a brilliant keyboard player. He produced that album. And then I wrote another song with a Peter Bliss called One Love. So, and then I didn't do anything after that until in 1991, I got together with Tony Visconti, and I met him through, I was trying to get hold of Justin Hayward when I did my album for Epic, because they wanted me to do a song that would be written by a well-known celebrity and maybe have that person as a guest. And the person that I chose to try and do that was Justin Hayward. And it was suggested that I call Tony Visconti because he was doing some producing for the Moody Blues at the time. And that was my first introduction to him. And he put me in touch with Justin, and we did The Angels Cry, which is also on the Epic album, the self-titled Annie Haslam,
yeah.
1989, yeah. So anyway, that's the first time I was in touch with Tony. And then there might have been another communication with him. But just before I found out I got breast cancer, I contacted Tony to say that I'd written these poems, like written these ideas down. Well, I knew he was a songwriter, and I just wondered whether he might be interested in working with me. And he said, yes, immediately. And he produced the album as well. It's called Blessing in Disguise, as you know. And most of the songs on there were written by Tony and myself. That was quite an incredible experience because he's one of the best. And we were doing demos for it for a few weeks. And then I got breast cancer. So it was a few weeks that I couldn't do anything. But when I was going through chemotherapy and I felt strong enough, I'd drive up from Philadelphia to Bucks County, Pennsylvania, up to New York City. And we'd carry on with the demos. I felt terrible. I felt lousy. But as soon as I started singing, it was wonderful. I felt like $1 million. And so we'd got a lot of work done. And I stayed up there a few days. And then we recorded Blessing in Disguise.
So, yeah, we're going to play the title track from that album. Do you want to say anything specifically about this track before folks hear it?
It's just me and Tony singing. And when I did it, it poured out of me so easily. The other ones were a little bit more difficult for me to get because, you know, I'm not a seasoned songwriter. And my mind's always full of millions of things. So I guess maybe that's why. This particular day, this poem came out, and I thought, I didn't really know what it was about. And I wrote it before I got the breast cancer. And when I'd got it and we were working on recording it, I said, now I know what it's about. It's about my breast cancer. How it was a blessing in disguise. It just kind of woke me up to many things, you know, to take care of myself and value friendship and just be more aware in all areas and be thankful for everything on this planet. Not that I wasn't, but it just, when you find out you're that sick, it changes your perspective on everything, you know. And so I felt like I'd captured it in this song, but this was before I knew that I had it.
Every drop of water descending like a pearl lays upon the silken skin of this perfect girl. The breeze around her body moved upwards to her face. It held on like a baby that found its resting place. Voices from the night before cannot be denied, suddenly revealing all the pain inside. Entering a well of thoughts, all her fears subside. All the bad things turning to a blessing in disguise.
She was the faintest flower washed in by the tide, sending silent messages to the world outside. Her face began to soften, her lips took on a smile. The people who had loved her came rushing to her side. Voices from the night before cannot be denied, suddenly revealing all the pain inside. Entering the well of thoughts, all the fears subside. All the bad things turn into a blessing in disguise. A blessing in disguise.
So a lot of church influence I hear on this, or maybe that's just Tony's arrangement.
I'm Blessing in Disguise?
Yes. I mean, just it sounds like a hymn. Maybe that's just the way the harmonies are.
You know, I never thought of that.
I shouldn't say that, because that brings to mind, if you did it in more straightforward, like we're marching down the aisle, every drop of water. It's not that kind of church hymn.
In St. George's Chapel's boys' choir, that would be good. Gosh, that would be beautiful. But I do have a story, actually, about this, if you'd like to hear
it. Yes, please.
I don't know what year it was. It was in the 90s. And a friend of mine worked at Windsor Castle in the chapel office. And there was some talk about some kind of event to raise funds to build a much-needed building to add on to the choir school that they had there already, which was in the grounds of Windsor Castle. The people in the office knew that I was a singer. You know, Northern Lights was a top 10 hit, and maybe we should see if Annie can do anything about it. I was feverishly looking into doing this and met with a man called Sir Patrick Palmer, who was the governor of the castle. So he was second to the Queen at the castle. Also had lunch with him in the Norman Tower, because he and his wife, Lady Joanna, lived in the Norman Tower. When you're the governor of Windsor Castle, you have the pleasure of living in the Norman Tower, which is very famous, and it's haunted. And this man was just a wonderful man. He'd write to me occasionally from England. I spoke to him once, and I said, I've just been trimming up the runner beans in the garden and picking the tomatoes. And this man probably never got anything like that, you know, like a real down-to-earth life kind of thing. So I think he was fascinated by that, but also he liked me, and he was very touched that I'd done a lot of work trying to make that concert happen. So I sent him Blessing in Disguise. And then I got a letter from him saying that he was leaving the castle because he'd become sick and he'd got cancer. And gosh, I was so upset. He passed away, and I got a beautiful letter from Lady Joanna saying he'd passed away peacefully at home, and they were playing his favorite music, one of them being Blessing in Disguise.
So it sounds like a lot of the meaning of these things is not so much in the writing, which might be a very, very quick thing, but is in the dwelling with it, the sharing it with other people, the singing it over and over and over again later, that it adds all these layers of meaning. And as you just said, that you're associating this directly with your own cancer experience and how the lyrics meant something to you in light of that, when that was not actually what was driving it at the time at all. I think it's a pretty rare for somebody to become an accomplished lyricist at this point, kind of, you know, it's not like Elton John is going to tomorrow just start writing his own lyrics, that he's kind of established, like, that's the way I do things.
When the band finally broke up, I think that it was almost like the floodgates opened for me. I was like a bird, and I think it was like my freedom in a way. But I didn't know it, and I did do it intentionally, and I didn't know it really. These things all came naturally. It's like my painting. I mean, God, I never knew I could paint like that. You know, I haven't stopped. I can't stop. It's wonderful. But, you know, if we carried on with the band, I might have never have known that I was a painter. But I'm always amazed, really, the things that keep unfolding for me. And I think if you're open to it, I know it's very difficult for most people today. You know, there's people multitasking with their work to survive. And if one can get into that position, you know, I don't meditate. I think I meditate when I paint. I can't clear my brain to sit down and clear everything out of my brain. No chance. But I think if people can just stop for a moment, they'd probably find that all kinds of things can happen. We're so powerful ourselves, just even one person, or if with somebody that's like-minded, or your husband or your wife, and you, then that's a powerful team. You know, there's so much we can do to change our lives.
So do you feel like in your dwelling with your lyrics after the fact that it's, you know, just a fundamentally different experience than when you were singing Betty Thatcher lyrics for all those years?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And Betty, I mean, good God, I would never put myself in the same category as Betty Thatcher. She was a genius. But she did say that she felt like she was plugging in. You plug in, you don't do it on purpose. So something happens in your body, it feels something, some change, and you plug into something, it pours through like water. Betty's words were just, oh, God, fantastic. And like Blessing in Disguise, you're saying about you don't look at it until like later on or whatever. That happens with my paintings. Nearly all of them is I don't know what the heck they are until later. And I sit and I look and I think, God, what have I just painted, you know? And then it'll come and it'll be like, wow, that's really powerful, which is wonderful. It's a surprise. But then some paintings, I'll need to do a pet portrait. So I have a picture of a pet and I look at that. So, but other times I just sit there and I do little paintings for my shows and I sell them at my shows, 4 by 6 inches, not feet, at my shows. Everyone just comes from a different place. I just do them and they pour out of me. And it's the same with the music, like Blessing in Disguise, that came from nowhere.
But it came from nowhere as a poem or?
Yeah, it just poured out of me. Like with Grandine Al Vento, there's a funny story regarding that, because that's one that I was planning to, you know, it wasn't like I was sitting there letting things pour out. It was something that needed to come out. It's kind of a love story, really, that's unfolding in my own life now. I guess, again, I was doing something that was coming up. I was writing something that I guess I was wishing for, but then it's happened. And that song did come very easily. I have a big mirror in my bedroom, giant mirror. It's almost the size of my wall. And that's how it starts off. The mirror becomes a door. And I used to think that. I look at it sometimes. I think that's got to be a door at nighttime. You know, something goes on with that mirror. I mean, mirrors are very powerful anyway, apparently.
Tell us, before we play that second song, the literal translation of the Italian there. Something about hail and the wind, storms.
You see, the thing is this.
Or is it not real Italian? It's just made up.
Oh, I tell you. Okay, this is what happened. Mickey sent me a backing track and he had a musical instrument playing the part that he wanted the words. And so I go through that and I go over and over and over and over and over and over listening to that. And then I write down how many syllables, how many words I need, you know, just by listening to that instrument that's the lead. And then I said, it might be nice to have something with an Italian title. I said, let's make it into a really big Italian ballad, you know, but not all of it, because I don't want to sing Italian. That's going to take me forever to learn that. But maybe the chorus, you know. So anyway, I wrote the words first, not thinking about how they're going to translate, and it was called Hail the Wind. So I looked it up online, which you should never do. I looked up online. I mean, what an idiot. This is a lesson for everybody else on the planet. Do not do this. I went online, and I looked for the translation. And it said Grandine Al Vento. And I thought, oh, my God, that's amazing. And I thought, Grandine Al Vento, you know. What I did is I changed the words to Grandine Al Vento, L'amour vient de me, whatever.
What's the vient de me? Love?
Love comes to Grandine Al Vento, L'amour vient de me. Yeah, love comes to me.
Okay.
Right. But I was singing me at the end of it as well, and I was singing Grandine Al Vento. That was the start of it. But anyway, I did a rough version, sent it to Mickey, and he was absolutely blown away. He said, oh, God, Annie, this is going to be gorgeous. Oh, my God. So we went in the studio and didn't think to check the translation. I did my lead vocals. It sounded phenomenal. And then we sent the rough mixes to the guys in the band saying, do you think there's anything more you want to put on, you know? And Jason Hart, who was one of the keyboard players, he called me up and he said, Annie, he said, I think you've made a mistake in the Italian. I thought, oh, God.
Too late.
Doesn't matter.
It's in your head. It sounds beautiful.
So he said, you know, you're doing it wrong. And I thought, oh, no. And I called Mick. I said, I've done it wrong. I'm not singing it right. And he said, you're singing me instead of May. And he said, what you're actually saying is you're talking about a hailstorm.
Yeah.
Not hail the wind, like, you know, with your arm up, hail the wind. You're talking about a hailstorm. So I thought, oh, God, what are we going to do? We decided that we were going to keep it, but I still wasn't singing it correctly. I thought, well, you know what? A love could come through a storm. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's all about love surviving anything.
It's a pun. It's fine.
Yes, exactly. But I don't mind telling the truth. So we got this friend in of Rave's. Rave is a producer, another keyboard player, my MD, and has been with me for many, many years. And he brought in this guy who was Italian and also a guitarist, and he came in to help me with the pronunciation. And first thing he said, you know, do you realize what you're singing here? You know, I was like, yeah, but I'd like to sing it properly. So it had to be Grandine, not Grandine. And then it had to be L'amour vient de me, not the me. So I did a run through and he said, wow, that's great. And I thought, oh, good, it's done. And, and 4 hours later, because I didn't get it right, I didn't get the pronunciation right, 4 hours later, we just decided that because it sounded so beautiful. I've had a couple of letters, not many, from people saying, what do you mean? Can you tell me what the lyrics mean? Because I'm Italian, you know. Oh, my God, you know. But it's a beautiful song. And when we do it live, everybody just, some people cry. It's a beautiful song. And it's about somebody that came into my life, but I didn't know it when I wrote the song.
I'm not alone, I'm quietly breathing, the mirror becomes a door while I'm sleeping, the rain, it falls. Lost in two worlds, I fly in silence, a song in the air, leading me somewhere, then somewhere.
Became a songbird. Grande
So here, it's less the church feeling and more the opera feeling, which I know was...
Yes.
Did I read that was your original training?
I was trained by an opera singer, yeah, for 9 months.
And Michael Dunford must have known your range extremely well, because if he gave you an instrument track that's like, follow this exactly, and it hits those exact points, the magic points in your voice to make it have that soaring, you know...
Well, we've been together, you know, for over 40 years working, and he knew my voice the same as Rafe Tesar does. You know, when you work with somebody for so long, they get to know I don't read or write music, and Mickey did, so they knew exactly what to do with my voice. And it's all right saying I've got 5 octaves. Most people think you can sing anything, but it depends what key that song starts in, you know.
Sure.
So it's not quite as easy and simple as people think.
Well, and I imagine that's probably shrunk a little over the years. I saw a recent concert and you're still singing these old songs, hitting the high notes there. Is it getting more difficult at least?
You know, obviously your voice changes, and I just didn't find out until like 6 months ago. I was doing an interview with somebody and somebody said, you're very lucky because your voice never broke. I said, what do you mean broke? And he said, well, you know, women's voices usually break. When they're younger, you get to an age and they get lower. I never knew that. Your voice dropped.
I didn't think it was just women. I thought it was, you know, every male singer who's reputed for their high piercing tenors when they were 20, they don't have those anymore.
Well, some of them lose it because of the drugs, you know, as well. And so my mother had a high speaking voice. So, I mean, I guess I'm very fortunate that I took after her. And my father was like a tenor, but he was an amateur singer, but his voice was, and my brother Michael, you know, he was managed by Brian Epstein. That's another story.
Yeah. I mean, are you still on a very strict regimen of vocal exercises?
I kind of save my voice when I'm not performing. I have to be careful because I'm working with toxic stuff when I'm painting, but I've got the airflow going in my studio and everything, but I'm just careful of what I start doing now, because the fall tour's coming up. We're going to be playing with a 10-piece orchestra, and which we're very excited about that. Wherever I go, I wear a mask, because people spread all kinds of stuff, and I get the weirdest looks and people going, ugh, what's wrong with you? And sometimes I look at them and go, there's nothing wrong with me. It might be you, you know.
I get sick every time I go on a plane, so that eminently makes sense.
Yeah, I know. I've got to be... Well, I wear a mask on a plane now.
Do we have any unfortunate YouTube footage of you with a cold trying to sing through a whole concert.
You can't do that, because if you sing with a cold, you'll ruin your vocal cords. You can't do that. You have to cancel. If your vocal cords are swollen, then you lose all your range. But what I did do, and my friend John Wetton has done it as well, we did it on tour. My voice went, and I had to go to the hospital, and the guy gave me some liquid to drink. It's Decadron. It's a steroid. And it opened my throat, because my throat was closed over, and it opened up and I could sing. It worked for two shows, and then we had a break, and then I got better, and we had some more shows. But, you know, it's possible to do things like that, but then you have to be very careful, because you can get very sick, and you can get candida on your esophagus, and all kinds of stuff can happen. So I'm careful what I, you know, drink. I don't smoke. I don't do drugs or anything like that.
Well, and it sounds like you just learned the correct vocal technique to start with. I remember being very surprised the first time I saw, I think it was Crowded House Live, that Neil Finn, who had been singing along with us on his records, and often just kind of yells through some of the more energetic parts, had obviously been coached by a vocal trainer, you know, for on the tour, you can't do that. You have to be very, very precise and light on everything. But there's basically no difference that I could detect, you know, seeing you live versus on recordings in terms of how hard you're pushing it. That's just, you're doing it right in the first place.
I'm breathing correctly. I mean, I'm breathing from my diaphragm when I sing, sure, which is the most important thing in the world for any singer. And that's my advice to anybody who wants to sing, is that you have to be different. You can't copy anybody else, and you have to learn to sing from your diaphragm. And then you'll be fine. You know, you find your own voice. That's the thing. You've got to pace yourself on stage. We used to do two shows at the Bottom Line in New York City. I don't know if you ever went there. It's a brilliant place. It's no more, unfortunately. And we did Ashes Are Burning twice.
The 25-minute version?
Yep. We did a long version of it each time. And it was difficult to pace myself because, I mean, I always feel like I have to give my all. But I managed it. But the second time through, I mean, maybe it was not quite as strong, but it was still good. You know, it was still fine. Nothing wrong with it. But it depends on the kind of singer you are and what you have to portray. If you're just in a rock and roll band, and I don't mean that in a rude way, and everything's like all on the same level as far as volume in your voice and everything, there's similar keys, then it's easier to pace yourself. But if you've got so many high notes, you know, all over the place, and then you've got to do an hour and a half show, and then you have a break for like half an hour if you're lucky, and then you've got to do another hour and a half show, that's kind of difficult.
And it seems you've resisted, you know, a lot of times somebody who's a female lead singer with a strong voice ends up doing a lot of harmonies against herself on the record. And so then when you'd play live, you'd have somebody who's just a touring, another woman, to even do harmonies higher than yours, potentially, that you could then kind of rely on.
Yeah, the guys have to do it, unfortunately.
So they can't fill in, they can't hit the high note if you don't feel like doing it every single time.
Yeah, but we do have like five voices on stage, so we can make it sound pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. You see the faces saying, I don't want to do that one. It's too high.
So you haven't dragged them into doing Blessing in Disguise with the full Gregorian Tony Visconti group? Is that verboten in terms of pulling in? I mean, I know even Michael worked with you on a number of your, right? Well, actually, the third song we're going to play, Precious One from the Dawn of Ananda. Was that the first project you'd done with him in a while, like 1999 recording-ish since breaking up?
Well, I think I'd done a couple of things for his musical that unfortunately never saw the light of day. But yeah, that was the first one for a while. Then after that, we did Tuscany, didn't we? That was afterwards, yeah. Yeah, Precious One.
Yep, trying to get the full band back together, yep.
So it was me, Mickey, and Terry, and John Tout, but not John Camp, yeah. And then we decided to make it a six-piece as well. But Precious One was for my Dawn of Ananda album, and all of the songs on there are about angels in some form. And a few weeks before, I had the pleasure of singing in the Town Hall in New York, which is where we're going to be playing with the chamber orchestra, actually. And I did an a cappella version of Summon the Angels, which was another song I'd written with David Biglin. And Phoebe Snow was supposed to be on this show. And what it was a kind of a seminar thing with John Edward, the psychic medium. And the guy who just started managing me was managing John Edward, and he called me up and he said, Annie, do you think you could come in with your band? And it was like this 2 days notice. I said, I can't. But I said, even Rave couldn't do it. It was too last notice. I said, I can come in. And I thought, oh my God, me and my big mouth, I'll come in and sing a cappella. I thought, why did I say that? Oh my God, you know, in the town hall, New York. Ah, what do I do? And I could have sang Blessing in Disguise because I've done that before on my own, completely on my own. I went in and I sang some of the angels.
So not a Renaissance classic where you can sing your verse and then you can just stand in silence for 2 minutes where the instrumental would go. And then...
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, but you could hear a pin drop there. It was like amazing and it was wonderful and I was terrified, but it worked. But before that, I'd been given John's book. And in the book, there was a chapter about this little boy called Mikey. And I think he lived on Long Island with his mum and dad. One day, Mikey was outside by the swimming pool. The mum and dad were out there doing a barbecue, and they turned around, and the little boy had fallen in and drowned. So John Edward had channeled Mikey on one of his, I don't think it was a show, I think they had a private meeting with him. So I was so taken by this story that, and this is when I was writing The Dawn of Ananda, the CD, and I said to Mickey, I said, I've written these words, can you write a song to go on the album? And he came up with the music, which was gorgeous, and he gave it to Rave Tesso, who's in the band now, the new band, and he was in my solo band, I've known him for a long time. He came up with the amazing arrangement. I mean, it's just, oh God, I cried when I heard it, and I just loved singing it. So anyway, the story after that was that I put it on the album, and then I wanted to send the album to Mikey's mother. So Rick, who was the manager, contacted her and said that I'd written this song for Mikey. Could Annie send it to you? And she was thrilled. I put it in the mail, and then she was driving her car one day, and Mikey, she got this message from Mikey as clear as day in her head saying, there's something coming in the mail today. And when she got home, it was my album.
Well, that's a good intro.
Unfolding as the storm clears, a woman left more wise. Thank you. is left inside.
Also a fairly minimal arrangement, not anywhere near the Tony Visconti one, but it's still quite a different feel from, even though this is a Michael Dunford song, from the Renaissance stuff.
Because he read the words, it wasn't appropriate to do anything big. He connected with it, but it sounds big. It's just the sound of it. It's so rich. My voice is one of my favorite songs I think I've ever done, ever recorded. I love the sound of my voice. I like singing low down as well. It's got a different timbre to, you know, my voice.
Some of the reviews and things I was reading of your solo work is, you know, getting in the new age Enya kind of just warm feeling in terms of both the, it's not a piercing vocal, it's a different sound palette than even the current Renaissance stuff, that the Renaissance stuff even now sounds very full, but in a more symphonic way. That is, it sort of verboten, given the history of the band and what the audience is expecting, to have a really gushy, warm synth sound that can just fill the whole stage by itself. Like, you have to, if you're going to have synths, they have to be like the pad at the beginning of Grande Il Vento, which still sounds like a synthesizer, but it's still kind of within the orchestral palette. It's not some big electronic mushy thing. So, I mean, is it just a matter of what producer you're working with in terms of what the overall sound of that particular album ends up being, or is it you come in to the project with, I want to evoke some particular feeling and have different things that would appeal to you and that you would approve or that you would suggest in terms of what keyboard sounds are used or how many layers are going on or that kind of thing?
I used to add my suggestions for arrangements with Renaissance.
Like, in, mostly in terms of what the vocal is going to do?
Yeah, what the vocals are going to do, and sometimes, you know, ideas for the orchestra things, bits and pieces, but not much, because I wasn't really into that side of writing or anything then. But now, since we got back together, and particularly with my own, I've been working with Rafe for so many years that he's right inside my head. And, you know, when we write anything or record anything, I'm in the studio every step of the way when anything's recorded. I don't just go in to do my vocals. I'm there when the backing tracks are done and everything, you know. And also with the Renaissance, the new Grande Il Vento album was the same thing. I'm hands-on with everything like that, and I'm there when everything's mixed. If I, for some reason, I can't be at a mix, there's always something not right that I don't like. So I have to make sure that I'm always there, because
I know that feeling.
Yeah, because, well, everybody's got their different ideas, you know. I think we were very fortunate with the producers that we had in the 70s, and a lot of them we produced ourselves. David Henschel did As You Adore, which is an okay album for me. A lot of people loved it, but that was kind of the beginning of the demise of the band, in my eyes. But we did most of them ourselves, and there were arguments, of course, but we did really get on well, so it turned out amazing, didn't they? The albums were amazing.
Right. Well, so much of production is arrangement. And when you've got a band that's so fixated on its own arrangements, then there's not a lot for a producer to do other than do it a little faster, you know, or can we make it a little louder here? You know, try to create some sonic effects in terms of the changes in dynamics through the thing.
I would think that most fans, and I don't know about big celebrities, want to be bothered with doing it, you know. It's being in the studio every minute of the day. But the thing is, I love it. I just love being in the studio.
I have found over time, you know, I did all my mixing myself for a long time, And I really like now, if I can get away with it, to just have the studio guy do the first 3/4 of the mix. Don't make me sit here and figure out drum sounds with you. Just do that. But I want to be really involved with where everything sits in the stereo space and how much reverb is on things and all those kind of things. But I don't have the technical expertise to say, add more mids to the guitar to make that pop out, that kind of exact thing.
Yeah.
One thing that's still a little mysterious to me, you know, there are a lot of folks that just write lyrics and they write them as poems on paper, send them off. And then usually when the singer is writing the lyrics, then it sort of, when you're looking at the co-writing credits, where the actual melody comes in is sort of a nebulous in-between place, because maybe somebody provides you with a backing track and you might say, okay, well, what am I going to do over this? Well, maybe things in the backing track are suggesting a melody. So I understand with Michael that he's actually giving you an instrument that has, this is the melody, and maybe you'll tweak it a little bit to emphasize something that occurs to you, like to make it a little more dramatic or whatever. But what about with all the solo stuff? Is that the same way it's basically worked with different composers, or have you taken a more active role some of the time?
Yeah, I was at all the Renaissance stuff. I mean, it was there. It's just I wasn't so knowledgeable back then.
Mm-hmm.
I am now. I love being a part of it. It's like a knowing. We all know or knew what we wanted it to sound like. You know, we were all on the same page. That was the wonderful thing. There wasn't really any, oh, no, that's not right. And this, you know, it was all pulling together. So my experiences have been, you know, excellent. Even when I've done guest things on people's albums, that's kind of scary if you can't be at the mix then. But, you know, it just seems to have worked out well. You know, I mean, I did Turn of the Century with Steve Howe, you know, and I was there for the mix of that. And then we did it live at my concert I did called Lilies in the Field. That was a benefit concert I put on in the 90s. And then I did Ripples, which was a Genesis. And that's another of my favorite recordings because I'm singing low. I just love it. There's a different richness there.
Well, I noticed you still, the One Enchanted Evening album is fairly recent, and that's all covers. That it seems a lot of the initial appeal of singing was interpreting these pre-existent things. You know, it's not necessarily that you've gotten so precious with your lyrics that, you know, everything that comes out of my mouth must be something straight from my soul, that you're still, you know, can appreciate and make your own. I mean, these are some very distinctive versions of these songs.
I had been doing, for 7 years, actually, these Christmas shows at Tinicum Lutheran Church in Pennsylvania. And it was an old church, held about 250 people, I think, something like that. And, oh, we had a wonderful time. So we had vegetarian Christmas food included in your ticket. We found out through the pastor, who was a brilliant man, great personality, and he said that the church was having a problem with the roof. So Rave and I said, well, maybe we could do a benefit concert and raise money funds for the roof. So that's what we did. And I said, it would be nice to do some of my songs that have meant such a lot while I was growing up. And that's how this was born. And one of the songs was She's Leaving Home, which is interesting because the Beatles channel on Sirius XM had me on there in August to talk about the song because they found out that I was going to be doing a tour and everything. And so they wanted to know if I liked the Beatles. And I said, well, yeah, my brother was managed by Brian Epstein and I recorded She's Leaving Home, you know. So we did that and they played it on the Beatles channel. Then last week, a friend of mine said, Annie, he said, I was in a liquor store in New York, and he said, I nearly fell over because the radio was on and She's Leaving Home was on the Beatles channel again. So that was wonderful. You know, it's just
that. So a project like that, does that end up being just a much more quick affair than the recent Renaissance album? I know that got re-recorded as extra tracks.
Yeah, it was just the two of us, you know.
Okay.
So, and we came off when we finished the show and it went down a storm and it was wonderful. Oh my gosh, wonderful. And we went, looked at each other and we hugged each other and went, who needs a band? Oh, we enjoyed it so much. It was wonderful.
So in interpreting standards like that, I mean, is it pretty much just don't overthink it, just learn it? Because it just sounds so precise. That album is, I guess that just speaks to how well the two of you work together.
Yeah, exactly. And I wasn't going to do any songs that I wasn't connected to. They were some of my favorite songs. So I was just dying to do something like that. You know, I loved it so much.
I always have trouble with some kind of, especially slow jazz ones, like so that you do If I Loved You. And that's such a, for somebody raised on rock and roll, it takes so long for the melody to kind of complete even a line that it's hard for me. I have to listen to that kind of thing over and over again before it like actually gets in my head, or go and listen to different versions of these jazz standards that people did fast, some did slow, and then it becomes a thing, but it's a little harder for me to internalize.
My father, you know, as I said, as an amateur comedian singer, and he sang If I Loved You was one of the songs, and also Nature Boy, which is what I did on there.
Right. So the last song here, A Symphony of Light. So this is the what is now the title track. It was originally released as Grandine il Vento, but now it's re-released just because you got a different organization that's distributing it and did a couple extra tracks. But this is the big Prague song, the big, you know, that it's long.
We went to a distributor. Now it's back in my hands. They wanted 3 bonus tracks and wanted to put it out again, but it's now back with us, so that's good. Anyway, yeah, you know, I'm a painter now, which if some people might not know, and I've got, if they go to anniehaslam.com, you can see my work. I wanted to write a song about Leonardo da Vinci, and Mickey presented us with this beautiful short piece of music to start with, and oh my God. And I said to him, I said, Mickey, I want to write about Leonardo da Vinci. He said, no. And I said, well, why not? He said, because it's too literal. I said, okay. I said, do you know this song? Starry, starry night. La da 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 da. I said, do you know who that's about? And do you know what it's called? It's called Vincent. And he said, oh yeah, oh really? Anyway, he said, but no, I don't think we should do it. So anyway, what I did, I took my giant book of paintings, of Leonardo's paintings, and I took it in the studio and I left it in there so that it could just mingle in the air and the atmosphere and the ambience. So he gave me this, I was going home and he was going to write the first parts of the song, and he gave me a CD and they put this on there, this piece of music, which was the beginning part of the song. I used to stop the car and I wrote it on the way home. It was pouring out of me, and it starts off with Leonardo when he was living in France. The King of France gave him an apartment for the last couple of years of his life and treated him like his own father. And so the beginning of the song is when he was an older man and he was in this beautiful apartment and he's got these windows from floor to ceiling with these giant thick red velvet curtains in there. And then in the morning he'd go to the curtain and he opened the curtains and he connected with the universal light. And that's what it's about. The beginning of the song is about that. And I did it and I sent it off to Mickey like within a day. And he said, oh God, that's gorgeous. And I said, well, it's about Leonardo da Vinci. <You know? laughs> And so he accepted it and it ended up as his favorite song. And it's very powerful. We've done it as, it's got different sections of slow, faster, where his life changes and he stops painting for a while because he's asked to come up with these inventions and it's money for his painting, you know. He needed that. And so he kind of put his painting on hold for a bit. And the music tells that story. And then it's just incredible. And then at the end, it comes up. When he starts painting again, it turns into this big classical ending, and it's like God summoned all angels.
Well, he must have some demons there, because there's some dark parts before we get to the end.
And that's where he's going through the struggle of doing the inventions and the weapons of war. You know, that's what that's all about. And the first time we played it live on stage, we got a standing ovation. And wherever we went, I mean, in Brazil, people were crying. I mean, I think a lot of people do. It's just incredible. And I think when somebody, you know, like I said, it's because I love Leonardo's work. He's my favorite painter. And a lot of fans now, they love my artwork. So they're really excited to see me doing it. And they're excited because I'm excited and I've done this song. It means so much. And when I sing it live, I've just put my heart and soul into it. And everybody just loves it. It's just absolutely gorgeous. It's one of the best things we've ever done as a band, I think. We both thought that. We're going to be doing that with the orchestra in New York and Philadelphia. We're filming, actually, the Keswick Theatre on the 27th of October.
People should look out for the live recordings of the new band, because it's kind of all, even though it's, you know, mostly different people than the 70s stuff, it still retains very much the spirit in terms of the roles. We have a keyboardist that can play really well and really fast. And now we'll have somebody else on bass who is doing very articulated, you know, very present lines and have the 12-string guitar. And, you know, so all the kind of the positions were established by that. And just having that in 21st century sonic technology plus video, like, is great. As I always helps the new songs, the old songs, etc. Well, thanks so much for doing this. I really appreciate your time.
No, you're very welcome. I really enjoyed it. And let me know when it's going to be on.
Will do. Here's Symphony of Light.
Sunlight poured through his bed. no man here on earth knew its real worth. One so wise, golden eagle flies, gold. Of the unreal, paled as it reveals certain plans, great secrets will be told. Visionary words, chariots unfurled, change of plans, radiant scenes on the hold. Water is to life, to the sky, signs that say a new world will unfold. Thank you.
Thanks again to Annie. Very, very spirited. If you check out renaissancetouring.com, you'll see that right now you can pre-order the Symphonic Journey with Chamber Orchestra DVD and even get your name in the credits. I will link to some of the YouTube footage of the current band. It's very cool. A lot of people dismiss prog rock as being this weird geeky thing. But Renaissance is not really prog in the manner of Yes and King Crimson, even though Annie is one of the go-to vocalists for various prog projects. She's played with Steve Howe and Steve Hackett, Patrick Moraz, Ian Anderson, Justin Hayward, John Wetton. She was actually engaged to Roy Wood, one of the original leaders of ELO. She also mentioned keyboardist Larry Fast of Synergy. I know him as the guy who made Shock the Monkey and that whole era of Peter Gabriel sound the way it does. So that was one of Annie's first co-writers. But despite all those connections to prog, Renaissance has a more folky aspect, I guess, or just more classical, a lot more piano in there. And even though writer Michael Dunford sadly is no longer with us, the guitar is actually not the most present part of that band. There's some really nice 12-string and acoustic things in there, but it's very much a keyboard band that often had actual strings behind it in the 70s albums. So the current band has two different keyboardists. She had mentioned Rave Tesar, her longtime musical director, on her solo albums. And then there's another keyboardist. So between the two of them, they cover the original sound very well. Anyway, it's pretty inspirational. There's so many musicians that make it big with a certain sound, and then they kind of stop. They get set in their ways. Maybe the output slows down. The songs start sounding more and more the same. Roger Waters, I am thinking of you. But Annie, after her main band breaks up, like, just develops this whole other side of her talent, not only in lyric writing, getting more involved in the arrangements and recordings, but also painting, as she kept bringing up. Very cool. And you should check out some of those paintings at anniehaslam.com. Again, if you enjoyed this, I hope you are subscribed to the podcast. I could really use your rating or review in the iTunes store or wherever you listen to this. Feel free to email me with any feedback or guest suggestions at mark@nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. And as you likely know, this is part of the Partially Examined Life podcast network. Check out my other podcast there at partiallyexaminedlife.com. For my next episode, I'm very excited to announce Alejandro Escovedo. If you would like to support this effort, please go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. Even the smallest donation would be extremely helpful, extremely appreciated. Hope you all have a great Thanksgiving, or whatever they celebrate this week in whatever part in the world you are, or at whatever point in the future you listen to this. Until next time, keep on musicking. This is Mark Linton Myers, signing off.